Hi, everyone. Welcome to Not Your Best Girl, a show with A-tier hosts and D-tier taste. My name is Kim. My pronouns are she, her, hers.
I'm Leanne, and I use she, her, hers.
And I just want to start us off with a reminder, if this is your first time listening to us, to check our description for content and spoiler warnings, as well as timestamps for each of the discussions that we have. And please feel free to skip any sections if you feel that would be necessary for you for any reason. And with that out of the way, I think we should move into our weekly check-in, which has a lot this week. We've both watched a lot of anime this week. Leanne, do you want to go first?
Due to some weird work circumstances, I've had more time than I had in the past couple weeks. So the first thing I watched this week was I decided to swallow my pride and say, all right, I have to know, and I watched Beastars. It honestly feels like an eternity since I watched this, given how much I've watched this week and the extent of the content that some of it contained, but I'm going to do my best to remember it in the best way I can. It falls into a territory that a lot of anthropomorphic animal content falls into, with herbivores and carnivores, a loose racial allegory, which I often find unearned and too simplistic and rife with problems, which could be its own essay, so I won't get into that too deeply. So what's the plot? One evening, an herbivore student gets murdered by a carnivore, so tensions and suspicions are high on campus. A wolf, Lagoshi, is a student at Cherryton Academy, which seems to have a decent performing arts program, although I'm still not quite sure what a Beastar is, though. Maybe
I was going to ask, is that like Beast Stars?
Yeah, it's definitely like a performing thing. Like, I'm the star of the beast. They may have described it better, and I was just probably playing FGO, but I try to pay attention. In the midst of the tension, though, he falls for a rabbit, Haru, and explores what it means for a wolf to fall in love with a bunny. Also, that size difference is wild.
Yeah.
I had more fun watching this than I expected, but it was also much hornier than I expected, which I don't know why I did not expect that. Mild spoilers, because I think this is something that has been on my mind. I'm still sifting through how I feel about Haru and the slut-shaming around her arc. She definitely has a good attitude about it, and there could have been a feminist commentary to it, but she gets very damseled in distress later, put in a very helpless and sexually humiliating situation. So instead of utilizing her own sexuality as a form of empowerment, which felt like they were getting somewhere about to do that with, she instead gets narratively shamed, feeling like a punishment for her promiscuity.
So have you accepted that you're a furry?
I did not accept that I'm a furry. And I'm trying to... I think there are reasons to dismiss and discount the show if you're really looking at Haru's arc and maybe some uncomfortability with that. Again, did my best to try and get past the, my reservations on, oh no, it's the furry anime, because I think there are also problems in dismissing a content for that altogether, even as easy and fun as it can be to say it as such, to frame it as such.
Brand new animal, took over the mantle of contemporary furry anime right now, so
supposed to be great.
People forget about Beastars as a furry anime soon, maybe.
It's gonna be a season two, and they ended on a cliffhanger.
Oh shit, well maybe not. I take that back. You're fucked.
And it was very well received, but yeah, I actually quite liked a lot of the characters too, and I think Lagoshi, the main character, might be theater design and tech rep. I kind of expected them to do the thing where he's going to eventually make the hard switch to acting, which, like, maybe he does as it goes on in the manga. But it was a moment where it could have happened, and then it didn't. So I'm actually very hopeful for that, because I'm so used to tech and design getting totally looked over in these narratives and being made light of. Yeah, and I like Rui. Again, it was a fun, quick watch for me. I zoomed through it pretty quickly. There's still that potentially unearned allegory and the bunny shaming. So if you want to watch it, proceed with caution, but maybe not for the reasons you think. But like, there is definitely animal sex.
Thank God.
A choice.
I'd be mad if there wasn't. Actually, I'm going to interrupt you because I know where you're going, and I want to talk about Fate Zero before you get into Fate Grand Order Hell, because I finished watching Fate Zero this week, and Jesus fucking Christ, what a wild ride it was, y'all.
Yay.
First thing I want to say, I love Waver Velvet. I know I said this last week. It remains true. So rarely are my faves actually the, like, valid faves. And I was so relieved when his whole arc was just, like, learning to be honest and trusting that people will like him if he's honest. He doesn't have to trick people into caring. I'm doing, like, the chef's kiss fingers thing. He's just, like, a sweet boy. And I, you know, I mean, he's also, like, kind of a snotty kid, but I love him. And I got a little confused with the lore bits at the end because it was my introduction to Fate. And there's a lot I knew that I was missing. And I tried to, you know, ask some questions while I was going through just to see if I could figure it out. And I don't think it took much away from my experience, but I am excited to figure out kind of what I was missing and maybe go back to it. I know I went into it and everyone said, like, oh, you're going to love Kuritsugu, because I really tend to, unfortunately, love the, like, sad, angsty sex man. But I think I was really turned off by, like, the 1 minute bit where he kisses Maya in the beginning. Because I just got so mad at him for cheating on his wonderful wife that, like, I couldn't get over it even for the rest of the show, even when he became more sympathetic and you started to realize, like, why he never showed a single emotion. But the whole time I was like, you didn't have to make these choices, my dude. Like, you didn't have to shoot the rocket launcher at the B-plane. There was no reason for this.
But it's devastating, Kim.
I mean, yes, it is. It was very sad. And the whole time I was like, this is very sad. But I was also like, there are 400 other options that you could have taken to not have to shoot the rocket launcher at your mom inside the plane full of zombie bees. Which is just a wild sentence to say, but I guess that's how fate works. Like, I still did feel things about him, but not as much as anyone expected me to. Wildly, the pairing I came out shipping most was Saber and Irie, which did make me feel incredibly good about myself, since I feel, like, good about that pairing. Most pairings on this show are not ones you feel good about.
No.
Speaking of, like, everybody knows that Gil and Kirei are fucking. We all, I feel like, know this. Everything everyone told me before I came into it implied this. I was not prepared for just how much they were fucking. You know, I was, like, channeling my inner Pro-ZD vine, like, oh, they fucking, literally the whole goddamn time. So anyway, Fate Zero was, like, a fun romp. I have the original Fate Stay Night downloaded on my laptop now, and I'll be getting into that soon. So expect more from me and my intro to Fate. But yeah, that's kind of what I have to say about that. I got very excited.
Yeah, well, as I am back in Fate slash Hell, I definitely have started revisiting the whole franchise again. We'll probably do all of the not good watches that there are now. But I will not really get into them because my Fate slash Hell is not as interesting as Kim's introduction to Fate, as I'm so excited and so sorry that she is about to get into more Fate.
I signed up for this. This is my birthday present to a friend.
That's a big birthday present, man.
Yeah, he deserves it because I ended up having to get a refund for his Christmas present because of COVID. So it's birthday and Christmas.
And I get a gift for no reason at all because of this.
You get a gift for being really lovely.
Another show I watched this week is Princess Jellyfish. I also watched this one relatively quickly and it had been on my list for quite a while, so I'm glad that I eventually got to it. I'm mostly positive on this one. I definitely was pretty immediately charmed by it, despite a couple hiccups. But the basic premise is that jellyfish enthusiast Tsukimi lives in an all-women's boarding house with other otaku women, but very distinct versions of otaku, such as the love of trains, or I believe one of them just loves older men, which I'm not quite sure how that falls in, but it is definitely portrayed as such.
Oh man, consider me that kind.
God, what's the name of the one you love from Showa Ringo?
Oh, from Rakugo Shinju? Fuck, Kiku? Kiku, the love of my life, an old, old man?
Yes, that one.
That one, I love him at any age, but he does get sexier with age.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm the one who says ten Miyoji can fuck, so. So all of these women have this intense fear of those they refer to as the stylish, and instead indulge their passions and in each other's company free of judgment instead of branching out into the outside world. One night, Tsukimi meets stylish Kuranosuke, who embodies the archetype they fear, but the two end up forming a quick friendship despite Tsukimi's initial reservations. The show blossoms into a romantic tension between the two, which coincides with complex and perhaps dated gender takes regarding Kuranosuke, leading to a lot of unfortunate humor. I will probably refer to that character as Kuro from here on. Definitely some of the show struggles with its portrayals of gender, and then the unfortunate gags that come with the confusion, especially with the no men allowed rule in the boarding house. But I also think there's a strong argument to make about gender expression and identity through that, that ultimately is very sympathetic, even if there was perhaps a lost opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And then, again, some unfortunate gags that come from that. I didn't expect to fall in love with the main romance plot line of this, but then I did. I ended up really rooting for the two, especially as they brought out the best in each other. There are definitely some unfortunate stereotypes that come in with makeover plot lines as well, but I do think that the show pushes back on this at times too. Another word of caution, this show has yet another case in an anime where sexual harassment is portrayed lightly because it's a woman harassing a man and literally drugging him at one point. Then there's also with the same character the ickiness of equating business success of a woman with her sexuality, and I probably talk and unpack this for the next hour, but what I will say is there's things to critique and be cautious of, but at the same time, the overall message is so positive that if you are able to watch despite those things or with those things in mind and critique them, that it's probably worth pushing through. And then I got another big show off my list that I had left there for a while and been, you know, aggressively perhaps avoiding.
I would say so.
Well,
as somebody who'd been harassing you into doing it.
Okay, but I started watching it, and then I started watching Eureka 7 for the competition, and I was like, to watch Neon Genesis Evangelion would be maybe too much mecha, and you cannot argue me on that because you also believe in too much mecha.
I do. I'm staring down Mobile Suit Gundam. It's coming for me, but mm-hmm. I'm just putting it off.
Yeah.
You're right. I can't talk shit.
And then I followed it up with End of Evangelion, which I didn't think I'd watch right after, but I gave myself a breather and went into it. Do we have the time for me to talk about everything I want to talk about with this show? Absolutely not. And we will talk a little bit more about Eva later and when we get into our deep dive. But what I will say, and just a few things, just to get some quick thoughts out. It took me way too long to pick up on Genesis in the title and why that's there. The show is really, really good at these tense pauses. There are several just wonderful moments of tension in the pauses. Potential spoilers mm-hmm. in a second if you haven't seen this, you know, 2-decade-old anime, which I hadn't. There's one great moment with Misato and Shinji at the train station, and I believe I texted Kim something along the lines of, I could sit in this sound design forever. There's the other great moment of Asuka and Rei in the elevator just not talking, or more Asuka not talking aggressively and Rei just, you know, being Rei. And you can, without Asuka doing much, you can feel everything bubbling in her. And then, of course, with Shinji and Kaoru before the squish. there's this great pause to which I was like, I know it's gonna happen, but is it going to happen? And like, what's gonna?
No, it stays there for like way longer than you expected it to.
A full, I want to time, actually kind of go back and time that. It might be a full minute.
It is. It's at least a full minute.
Mm-hmm.
I remember because I was like watching the timer tick on the screen, because I kept hovering over it, like, did my screen freeze?
Oh.
No, it did not. I actually went to a convention panel at MAGFest this year that talked a lot about that scene specifically.
Shout out to in-person panels.
Yeah, I miss conventions a lot. But it was talking about the use of, like, Western classical music in anime and talked a lot about that scene and, like, the way that that music is used specifically to invoke trauma, though that's just kind of the whole Evangelion bit, is how many ways can we symbolize trauma in this show?
Speaking of trauma, I want to give Asuka a hug. That's another big take I have. And then, speaking of music, my favorite line probably in the whole entire show, and then, well, this one's from the movie, is, this is just like when I started playing this is just like when I started playing cello. Weird comparison, Shinji. That's all I've got for now. I mean, that's not all I've got, but it's those are the only takes I have of Evangelion. Nothing else of import. Continue.
Otherwise,
on.
You're like, it was fine. It was like a fine show. Whatever. Yeah, no thoughts.
I napped.
Fuck. I remember at the beginning, like, it does start off more boring in the beginning, but you texted and you were like, does this show ever get less boring? And I was like, you have no fucking idea.
I mean, like, I knew it would. Part of the reason I texted it is because there was no part of me that was like, does it actually get less boring? But I was like, it starts slow. And I stand by that it starts slow because it's a lot of information at once and Asuka isn't there yet, so.
And then when she picks up, the show picks up. And it has my favorite episode, which is her and Shinji with the crop tops learning the synchronized dance. But this is not my take on Evangelion Week. So I'm going to move us to our next section, which is our check-in on our ongoing challenge, #MamaWatch, #Mamathon, where we are slowly but surely working our way through every single show in Mamoru Miyano's filmography. This week, I was in Pretty Boy Fujo Bait Hell, which is just a delightful place for me to live. I feel like if I was 13, I would be bathing in my favorite things right now. I'm not 13, so I'm not. But I have a lot to think about right now. I watched the first season of Black Butler, which, oh boy, I really have a lot of thoughts about how this show, like, symbolizes gender and what it's trying to say about gender, in addition to what it's trying to say about, like, sexual assault and trauma. It feels like the show kind of, like, stuck its hand into, like, a jar full of interesting and intense topics and then just kind of pulled out random ones and threw them at the screen. It doesn't really, so far, dig into them in any sort of real meaningful way, but it prods at them enough that I, like, keep expecting it to, which, knowing what I know about the show, I, like, really maybe shouldn't. That being said, like, I just keep thinking about, like, who is this show for, right? It's rated TV-MA, but there's very little actual gore or nudity, even though that's what the warnings are for. It's more thematically, like, TV-MA, which is kind of a weird way to say it. I don't know. I'm going to hold off on my thoughts until I finish the whole show, which I'm going to try to do this week or next week. But boy, I want to write a paper about this when I'm done. And I also watched Carnival, which is a 2013 anime about a national defense agency named Circus, where they do all end up dressing as, like, circus performers, and they are all mostly pretty boys. It's got a lot of, like, weird fantasy elements. They're demon hunters. The plot is kind of all over the place, but it made me really happy watching it. I think the plot is all over the place because there's, like, 15 main characters with plot threads that don't really get the time that they need, but the character relationships were really compelling and less bait-y than I expected. They mostly all just sort of felt like familial relationships. A lot of, like, older brothers and, you know, siblings, you know, found dads and all that. This was another one where Mamo's character was actually my favorite. He plays Yogi, who's a, like, pretty boy blonde guy who's, like, kind and fun and friendly and just, like, really wants everybody to get along and dresses up like Nyan Perona, like this giant yellow cat, and, like, parades down the street giving candy to orphans. I love him. Also top notch was Hiroshi Kamiya as Gareki, who's, like, one of the two main characters. and I just want to adopt this child, like, aggressively. So I'd recommend the show if you were bored and you wanted something that was lively, entertaining, a little bit emotional, and a quick watch. And speaking of quick watches, you watched a lot this week, Leanne.
Yeah, I watched a lot, but one of them totaled about an hour and a half, as all four series did. But this week in Mom-a-thon, coffee. The quality of these shows aside, they made me want to drink coffee. So I watched four series of Rainy Coco. If you don't know about Rainy Coco, that makes sense. The four series are as follows. Rainy Coco. Rainy Coco, Welcome to Rainy Color. Rainy Coco in Hawaii. Rainy Coco, Amecon. With 3 exclamation points. Thankfully, I am exempt from watching the last one, Rainy Coco Sai G, which I guess is called that because they're girls. It's so, Mamo isn't in it.
So you don't have to. Woof. Thank God.
What is Rainy Coco even about? Is there a plot? Who's it for? Does anyone watch it? Why does it have 5 seasons if no one seems to care about it? It's about a coffee shop that cute boys either work at or frequent. The quotes are because of the art is just, and the quotes that I exemplified with my tone in cute, are because the art just isn't that good. On what circumstances would I recommend this? Only if you want to watch something very quickly so that you can say you've watched more anime, because I get a sort of endorphin rush when I check off something new. So that part was nice. But otherwise, there's really nothing to this show. The plots are relatively non-existent. The characters are not even that memorable, despite the fact that it seems to be like, we have this ensemble cast, and then the cast will change every season. You know, there's one season that Mamo's character said, I think, like, 3 words. And that's why I had to watch it. But again, this whole season takes, like, 24 minutes, so... Yeah, that's that. The other Mamo watch I did this week was Tokyo Ghoul Route A. The coffee bit is that coffee is the only thing ghouls can consume other than people, because science. Well, I enjoyed season one of Tokyo Ghoul more than I had expected to. I thought the character relationships and the complexity in being a ghoul and maintaining said relationships were well handled, if not a little underdeveloped, that Toga and others were great, and the stakes were high while concise and manageable. Route A took all those good points and went, nah, let's be edgy. It felt like a different show that got stuck with the surviving characters and then just did not know what to do with them. So their characterization suffered, poor Toga became the absence of her former self, and IDK what Shu was doing there at all. Shu is Mamo's character. He was a fun take in the first one and actually quite enjoyed the theatrics of his character and a very charming minor antagonist. That's the other thing I just don't get about this show is that the characters seem to have these great horrific moments together and then it just feels kind of forgotten after it happens. Because as far as I understand, he should not be hanging around the main cast in the second season, but he's just kind of there and just really wants to eat the main character, but, like, you know, just hangs out instead. And one of my greatest problems with Route A is that it falls into the trap of believing that raising the stakes means raising the scale. But when the scale becomes overwhelming, the stakes feel non-existent. I felt essentially zero emotions watching this. However, there is this incredible character death flashback, perhaps the funniest I've ever seen, where the character who just passed away tells the character who's remembering this, if you were to die, I'd be sad. In defense of Route A, the last episode was, I think it was pretty well crafted, and recalled to a lot of the stronger points in the first season in by reining the stakes back in again. However, it feels just a little unearned after the clusterfuck that the rest of the season was. I would recommend Tokyo Ghoul Classic, the first season. There's a cliffhanger at the end of season one that pushes you to feel as though you have to keep going and you won't complete the story. So it's a really hard show to watch in isolation, which I have done with certain longer shows where I've heard the quality drops is appreciate the show in a one season format, but I just don't think you can with this one. But now I have to watch 2 seasons of Re and I think an OVA, but I don't have to pretend to care as much anymore, so I'll likely be playing Fate Grand Order in the background. And lastly, I realized that Fate Grand Order counts as part of this competition because there are several Mama-voiced servants in it, even if I don't play with any of them. I mean, I have some of them, but technically, it counts, so I can feel like it's research.
I'm really glad that we decided to count video games, because, yeah, it meant I got to count Jump Force, where Light Yagami is, like, half a story villain.
Count video games, but not require video games, because there are some we just can't access.
There are some we can't access, and also, I don't want to do every single Kingdom Hearts game in Japanese.
I don't want anyone to do every single Kingdom Hearts game, but that's another story for another day.
I got bad news about how a lot of people are doing things right now.
They'd be playing Persona instead. What a happy life.
So I think something that we have been thinking about this week, as Leanne kind of worked her way through Evangelion, was our perception of, like, these more, like, generic sort of quote-unquote or, like, blank male anime protagonists. You know, protagonists who don't seem to have much of a personality, or whose personality seems to be sort of like stock or cardboard, kind of the same no matter what happens, who don't seem to be very dynamic, I think prompted by Shinji being somewhat of the most obvious example of this and being a huge subversion of it. I think we were talking about, why does everybody hate Shinji so much? And I'll get into it later. I think there are very legitimate reasons and also very not legitimate reasons. But I think when we were talking about it, we sort of realized, and, like, correct me if I'm wrong, I think we sort of managed to sort them into several camps. Typical shonen hero, which is similar enough to typical isekai hero, and then a harem or a dating sim protagonist. So perhaps we can start talking about, like, each sort of category, some examples, and why we think that they are. I can start us off by talking about our boring shonen boys. Although we might want to give a disclaimer that neither of us have watched, like, the Shonen Jump Big Three. At some point, I am planning on watching every single episode of Naruto. Fuck everyone who says don't watch filler. I'm gonna do it. When we were talking about sort of your typical shonen heroes, and this is not to say that we don't watch shonen, because I think we both have watched a lot of shonens. Mm-hmm. I, myself, have watched over 500 episodes of Yu-Gi-Oh's, which are shonen-y as all hell, and have watched a fair amount of Pokemon as well. But yeah, I think these are sort of exemplified by, like, the Ash Ketchums of the world. You know, they're, like, young and plucky, optimistic. They get defeated, but they brush it off. Always looking on the bright side of things, trying their best to become the champions. And I think that Hinata from Haikyuu is a fairly good example of, like, a well-developed version of this sort of stock character. I know that you may not agree as much, Leanne, but I think he kind of shows that you can do this trope and have it be interesting.
I mean, yes, like, definitely there is the trope and the construction, but I struggle with him being one of the first people we bring up on a, like, kind of blank character list, because he definitely has a lot of complexity. Especially when you look at him in comparison to Ushijima or Washijo, the Shiratori Izawa coach. But we don't need to dive into that, because we talked about Haikyuu a heck ton last week.
Listen to last week's. I think maybe a good sort of example so far is Tanjiro from Demon Slayer, who, you know, has a fairly interesting story. He has, you know, a traumatic backstory, but he's just kind of the same character the entire time. Like, he's very nice and kind to people, and, you know, fights, but isn't overly masculine, but, like, he doesn't really have anything else outside of that. He doesn't do much, necessarily, other than, like, what he's told to do, and he doesn't seem to necessarily question anything or have a developing sense of morals. Maybe this will change. I'm 15 episodes into the show, but I've talked to folks who say that it really doesn't. But, you know, we'll see.
Yeah.
And this is not to say that you can't have, like, a very nice protagonist who's still interesting.
Right. I think Midoriya in My Hero is a very good alternate take on this, where he is, I would say, very interesting, especially when you look at his progression with idolatry and then finding his own self through that and finding how do you find identity through idolatry, etc., 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 while still having his own complexities and complex relationships with other characters. He has this very, that again, you first meet him and you see that very chipper, happy, I have all the energy and belief in the world, I just want to be a hero, I don't care what my ability is, I just want to be a hero, that we see in a lot of these typical protagonists.
The Narutos, although from what I understand, Naruto gets a lot of development. So I'm looking forward to that when I watch all 700 episodes of Naruto. I was thinking also about Judai Yuki from Yu-Gi-Oh! GX, who for the first, 100 or so episodes of the show is very, very much just this. You know, he's very much like, we're gonna fight. We're gonna, you know, get your game on. Like, this is gonna be the whole thing. Like, I want to fight everyone, and if I lose, that's fine. I just want to get better and play some fun games with my friends. And then he becomes kind of a subversion of it as well, in that, like, in the back third of the show, he takes a very dark turn and ends up falling, like, committing several, like, horrific acts in an alternate dimension. It also kind of becomes an isekai. Yu-Gi-Oh's fun and weird, but he commits, like, many, many horrific acts, like, gets possessed, has a whole depression arc where he feels really guilty for, like, killing all of his friends, and ends up kind of becoming a shell of himself and, like, realizing that, like, without this, like, happy persona, he's not sure if people will care about him. Of course they do, because it's Yu-Gi-Oh and it's a sap. But you don't get that if you only watch the dub, because the dub ends with him dying. The sub literally, like, the dub, 4Kids fucked up so badly and didn't license, like, the fourth season where he comes back and, like, has this wonderful mental health arc. So the season 3 ends with him literally, like, sacrificing himself and dying in English.
Spoilers for Yu-Gi-Oh! In English.
Yeah. It's fucked up. People like to compare Yu-Gi-Oh! To Pokemon, but Yu-Gi-Oh! Is infinitely darker in many ways. But yeah, I think when we're thinking about these characters, I think one reason that they tend to be like this is, like, they're supposed to be, you know, inspiration for their demographic audience of, like, young boys. You know, they want to have someone who is acceptable for young boys to look up to, and who they can aspire to be, who they can project onto and relate to, and see as, you know, a role model for themselves.
That's definitely true of, like, again, I still don't know if I view any of these quite in the same way as I view the blank characters we're about to more get into, but, you know, the Kainata, right? The whole point was they wanted to get kids to play volleyball too, right? Because mm-hmm. volleyball was a dying sport. So by having Hinata have a go-get-em attitude despite not having experience, you know, that's supposed to get kids up and playing volleyball too.
I mean, it worked.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're trying to sell something, whether or not it's a sport or a game or a personality or a belief, having a relatable main character for your demographic is key. Moving on from that, we can talk a little bit more about who brought us here, because I don't think that Shinji's trying to sell anyone anything.
No.
And if he is, it's failing miserably.
Yeah, I think that's probably why I'm not quite as sold on, even though there's a genericism to a lot of the plucky, happy-go-lucky protagonists, I think they're more in an inspiration way, and whereas these, maybe some of the more blank characters we are coming upon are going to be more of a potential to self-insert way.
Yeah, I mean, well, do you want to talk a little bit about your impressions of Shinji, since you just watched it this week?
Yeah, I did not expect to watch Evangelion and become a certified member of the Shinji Defense Squad. I definitely found him a lot more sympathetic than most people seem to. I've heard a lot of Shinji hate, so I went in with that impression, and he's definitely boring in the beginning, for sure. Like, I'm not going to argue that. I kind of came into it, and, you know, I was like, where's Asuka? I'm bored. Nothing, I can tell that big things are happening, but I'm not really driven by these characters yet and how they're experiencing things. Eventually I was, by the ones who were already there, but it just took me a minute. But Shinji is a relatively blank character. We don't know a lot of his personality outside of the fact that he's pretty quiet. He's definitely a little sad, definitely going through some puberty-like things, and plays mm-hmm. cello.
He's just your average kid, you see.
Right, exactly. And it's, I think there's an intentionality in that. In this big, sweeping, Fate of the World stakes anime, this story often remains his and focused on his psychological development and trauma, especially considering that how this affects combat too. It's pretty apparently mentioned in the story and not just something you can walk away from. You can't not be aware of the psychological states of these characters as being embedded in the greater plot. I think it's hilarious that there are people who respond to Shinji with great dislike because of his whininess, as though if you were abandoned by your father and were essentially forced by him, not as a son, but as an employee, do the children get paid? I do not know.
God, fuck, I hope they get paid.
Right, I mean, they all live in the same apartment, so... And I'm not sure. But forced to save the world in a mecha embedded with the soul of your dead mother at 14 years old, that you'd be fine.
No, whenever people complain about him being whiny, I'm like, yo, come on. Like, I get that you don't need to want to watch it. That's fine. But like, gang, have one iota of sympathy. And this is why I have problems supporting the get in the robot meme. Although I think that he often should get in the robot. I think a lot of it comes from like this very sort of like homophobic and like quote unquote like toxic masculinity. Well, if I was him, I'd just do the thing that needed to be done and like his problems don't matter. And I'm like, ah, yes, you have never been a child.
People are out here complaining about the Q-tip test. Proves to me that they have never experienced any kind of real pain.
Fuck. I mean, like, you're right and you should say it.
But yeah, I mean, if you think that you wouldn't whine in the situation, if you wouldn't be scared and confused at 14 years old, or now, unless you're 14. I don't think so. I'm gonna cut that.
In which case, congrats on having watched a lot of anime.
Yeah. If you think that you'd be fine, you have really high opinion of yourself, I would say. But...
Mm-hmm.
I think this is but kind of circling back a bit more to the topic, I think this is a case where, and I totally understand the genericism of the character, why he's a little more blank in the style and setup, because the less fantastical Shinji is, the less exceptional he is, the more the story can center on his trauma, the more that the show can reemphasize that he's just a kid. And I think where perhaps maybe it fails is that I think you should be able to watch what Shinji is going through and sympathize with him without him having these very overblown character traits, these very colorful character traits. You could maybe see yourself in his shoes and being scared as well.
Yeah, I mean, if we're talking about, like, characters reflecting, like, being, like, a self-insert, right? I think Shinji, for many people, reflects uncomfortably upon them.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to think that you'd be Shinji. You probably would. Or maybe you wouldn't. I don't know. But many people would be. And I don't think there's necessarily anything horrifically wrong with that. I mean, like, I find myself defending Shinji as well to people. Even though I think he pulls some absolutely, like, 100% reprehensible shit.
Oh, yeah.
He has absolutely no sense of his own boundaries. Which is, like, the theme of the show, right? I mean, literally at the end, it's, do you want to have boundaries or not, Shinji? And him choosing to finally have boundaries is, like, the big final choice. But his lack of boundaries often means that he invades those of others and commits really, really horrific acts, including, like, assault. And, like, so I'm not going to say that, like, you know, Shinji doesn't do anything wrong. But I think that nobody's criticizing him for those things. They're criticizing him for being whiny, which...
Yeah, I found that a lot of people overlook assault in their critical analysis of anime, which you can discuss the character and acknowledge the genre and maybe how the genre perpetuates it in a way that is unfortunate. But those those concerns still need to come up, and they still need to be part of that discussion, especially if you're going to center your discussion on undesirable traits of this character.
Yeah. And, like, moving off of Shinji to another show, which is basically just an Evangelion knockoff, which is Future Diary or Mirai Nikki.
You're gonna piss somebody off.
I mean, no, like, it is. It literally...
I have not watched it. I'm just...
I know. I mean, like, I watched Future Diary and had a lot of fun with it outside of the many, many horrific things in the story that the story does not treat as horrific as it should. Like, this is a show that, like, uses sexual assault for shock value in, like, the fourth episode. It's not what I would call a good show. But Yuki Teru Amano, who's the main character of Future Diary, is just Shinji, but unsympathetic. I think he makes more choices than Shinji does, and therefore loses a lot of audience sympathy, because you start to go, okay, well, you know, it's not just things happening to you and you being passive, although he is that. It's that eventually, like, he starts making more and more choices, either by being passive and therefore letting them happen, or by, like, actively choosing them, that make him an unsympathetic character, while somehow managing to remain incredibly boring. And it's okay, because he's surrounded in a cast full of, like, really, really dynamic characters. But Yuki himself sucks. He's like all of the parts that people complain about with Shinji, but almost none of the trauma. The show does not indulge in any sort of, like, real examination of Yuki's backstory. They kind of give him a couple throwaway lines, and his dad, like, kind of sucks, but it's not, like, you don't spend time in his head thinking about that. And there are other characters that go through way more severe traumas that get a lot more time with it, so his feels pretty, you know, low-key.
I at least know his dad's not Gendo.
He's just there to kind of be there. I think, notably, each character gets their own sort of diary, their future diary, that, like, helps them win this killing game. That's the main driving force of the show. And each character's diary tells you a little bit about them, the kind of diary that they keep. His diary is described as the indiscriminate diary, where it just kind of tells him whatever he sees, which I think really exemplifies his, like, bland protagonist status. So whereas, like, I think Shinji is supposed to be, like, sort of a deconstruction of this archetype, Yuki, who comes, you know, 15 years after Shinji, just does it in a sort of frustrating way. Yuki also reminds me of other bland boys from fantasy shows, like moving into our sort of, like, isekai protag, like, chauvinist kind of bland boy. I know that, like, on the internet people love to talk about Kirito from Sword Art Online being this character. I don't know. You, Leanne, you've watched Sword Art Online. I haven't.
I watched the first season of Sword Art Online back when it came out when I was in high school, and I did not watch past that. I was pressured into finishing the first season after watching the first half and starting the second half and going, like, no, this isn't for me anymore, but was promised that it would get better and then got angry. Yeah, I mean, to talk about Kirito is to talk about nothing, is to talk about all the entire isekai protagonist archetype, which is to have a rather nothing personality character, right? You know, it's very easy for ones that start with an MMORPG or video game type isekai, because those characters open up the opportunity to be shut-ins or the like, and therefore a lot of these isekai protagonists come across as blank and boring, because for these shows to work, they need to not have connections to home. They need to not be missing home. They need to not be missing their friends. They need to be able to fully integrate themselves into this world. Otherwise, the show would have to take the time to unpack the trauma of being away from your family and friends, etc., and make the characters want to leave. And I think a lot of shows don't want to dive into that or are not interested in that. They're interested in, like, oh, but does he get it on with this sexy elf? And there's no time to unpack that.
Yeah.
When your MC has no friends or substantial life to speak of back home, they can fully embrace the isekai. And this doubles down when the isekai has harem elements, so that it allows the viewer the opportunity to self-insert.
Hoo boy, yeah. No, I mean, I watched the first season of Overlord for our challenge, and I could not tell you a single thing about Ein Zolgaun, the protagonist. The first season of Overlord that I watched as a whole was incredibly boring, but I think part of why it was so boring was because I couldn't figure out the main character's feelings or motivations the entire time. You learn nothing about his life before he gets stuck in the video game, which is, like, I know it's not the point, but you can't have, you know, a dynamic main character who has a lot of connections to people, because that is often how you learn about characters, is through their connections with others. And if you're going to sever those immediately, then it's not going to, you know, it becomes the focal point, which is literally what you just said. So I'm just agreeing with you heavily here.
He's a skeleton, right?
Yes. I mean, so, like, that's his avatar. Like, I don't know what the hell he looks like in, like, quote-unquote real life, or if he died in real life, because it's weird at the beginning.
But I think that actually works really well with the self-insert, right? Because, you know, deep down, we're all just skeletons. So I think, I mean, anyone can watch the show and be like, well, that could be me, because I'm not even seeing someone who doesn't look like me. There are some discrepancies, of course, that there can be, but at the end of the day, that is going to be the most universal protagonist you can come up with.
Fuck. I mean, I guess. This is me doing the, like, I guess guy meme, because Jesus Christ.
I'm going to die on this hill. I feel really strongly about this, and that just came to me, so.
Well, congrats. You have officially broken it. You did it.
I cracked the case.
No, I mean, I think I talked a little bit about Nobunaga Concerto, like, last week or the week before. Even though it's not technically an isekai, like, Saburo has, like, no feelings about the fact that he gets stuck in the past. And he has no personality, like, outside of being a little bit lackadaisical here and there, because he has to play this role of, like, Oda Nobunaga. Mm-hmm. So it makes him actually the perfect protagonist for that kind of story, because he slots into being someone else so well. Another example, I thought, even though it wasn't, like, technically the same as the others, it feels the same. And maybe that's why I had such a hard time connecting to Nobunaga Concerto as a show.
I definitely would say, if it's not isekai, which I think you could potentially argue it to be, it's at least isekai adjacent.
We'll have an episode where we fight over what is and isn't an isekai.
I just want us to then really land on Fresh Prince being an isekai, and that's my only goal.
Fuck.
I think another recent example, which I'm a little scared to mention because I know that the webtoon is expansive and I have not touched it, and I've only watched the anime of Tower of God, but Bam or Yoru, I don't know, I don't fully understand the name thing, but Bam or Yoru comes across as very bland, and his backstory gives very little. Like, the backstory we see in the first episode is essentially, he's in this cave thing alone, and then meets Rachel, and then Rachel goes away, and then he goes, well, I want to follow her. And, like, as far as we know, that's his whole life. And his only motivation is, well, gonna find Rachel, gonna stay with Rachel, gonna protect Rachel. And so there's not really anything else to his character other than, oh, but he has powers. So it's and these are different than everyone else's abilities. So
fair enough.
Because I do enjoy the show, and I just feel like I very much enjoy it outside of him or despite him. He doesn't take away from the show, but he doesn't contribute other than the plot framing. And I do think there's a lot of ways to take advantage of this blank character trope, right? I think to just say it's a failure doesn't recognize where it can be useful and utilized and is intentional. I do think, yes, a lot of Shinji's was intentional, but I also think some of it was unintentional. I think in Ajin, Demihuman, Nagaike is a more interesting case with a bland protagonist. They think there's very strong intentionality with him coming across the way he does. We definitely get a lot of protagonists in anime who start as bland and then become more complicated and morally gray as the show goes on, in a way intended to be edgy that ultimately plays a less exciting, looking at Kaneki from Tokyo Ghoul. But I think where K works is that he looks the part of the generic good guy protagonist, and I resisted him at first because I expected him to be that. So I expected to be bored by him and not get much from him. But he subverts this by starting off sort of reprehensible from the beginning, having a rather cold and unsympathetic view of the world, His entire goal is to get his boring life back, not caring if others get hurt along the way, not caring about the potential disasters that are about to plague Japan. And he does not care if anyone gets hurt along the way, or specifically targeting good boys like Ko, who did not deserve any of the things that Kei did to him. Ko is a good boy and forgives really easily. And I got a little loud for my loud boy. What makes Kei fascinating is that he holds on to this refusal to cooperate and save the world far longer than most protagonists do. Over a season, at least, you know, in the way that the show is framed. I don't know how the manga is framed. But the show even points out at one point that Ko perhaps makes more sense as a protagonist than Kei does based on archetypes. Hirasawa tells Kei, that Nakano kid is good at gaining other people's trust. If you were in the same class at school, he'd be the popular kid and you'd just be some loser. But this isn't school. We're going to need to make decisions that go beyond morals and emotions, and you're able to do that. Ko has the drive to be and desire to be a hero, but he doesn't have the strategic skills and intellect that Kei has. He's loud and passionate, but fumbles, whereas Kei doesn't accept fumbling, and that's his coldness, and his coldness is what makes him less desirable as a hero, and perhaps makes him read as far more bland. And in that same scene, he qualifies his apparent lack of heart as related to how his dad lost everything by having too much heart. And there's like a certain thing about him being a surgeon and getting black market organs for his patients. I think there's like a whole show that could be right there, but I digress. I'm curious to see where he progresses in the manga or if he just simply regresses. Ultimately, I find that Ajin takes this bland protagonist and wants us to think that and wants to subvert that and wants us to question that.
The more you talk about Ajin, the more I actually want to watch it at some point. Maybe I will.
I think I actually really like it. It gets a lot of hate for the animation style, but I got used to it pretty quickly.
Fair enough. I mean, I had to get through Nobunaga Concerto, so I'm used to it.
It's all that. It's the Netflix thing that's on all of them. Like Blame and Beastars.
Someday we'll finish Blame. So I guess moving from there, I think there's like one third category that we haven't really talked about that we mentioned at the beginning, which is like the like sort of harem protagonists, which are similar to isekai protagonists in that they're like kind of supposed to be self-inserts, except that like harem protagonists are basically always self-inserts.
Mm-hmm.
And like they're very blatant most of the time about being that. And in order to be a self-insert, you have to be generic, because if you have too many character traits, then your audience won't relate to them. And the first one that comes to mind for me is Natsuo from Domestic Girlfriend, who's the most boring kid in the entire world, and I don't understand why any of the characters are into him. Interestingly enough, with Domestic Girlfriend, I feel like his boringness and like sort of nothingness makes him like one of the least objectionable characters on the show. In a show full of very objectionable characters and objectionable decisions, he makes some bad calls, but a lot of those are due to him being taken advantage of by, like, older women in his life in a really fucked up way. I didn't dislike him, but I did spend the whole show like, what are we doing here? Why are you like this? He wants to be an author is his only defining trait.
We love the single defining trait, such as Haru likes mackerel, and that makes him unique.
Free is a high-quality show. I don't know what the hell you're talking about. I said that like I was kidding, but we both know that we both really enjoyed Free.
Not to be a broken record, but again, it's the harem protagonist or the dating sim protagonist, as we can get into too, is a blank slate so that you can invite the audience to self-insert and imagine, you know, yourself with these characters. It's the step away from those first-person shows, which are deeply creepy to me, but to each their own.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you talk about, like, dating sims, especially in, like, visual novels, you need to have a sort of blank protagonist for most of them, because so much of the story that is being told depends on character choices, and you're going to have to build a character who's flexible enough that no matter what the player chooses, it makes some kind of sense. And, like, obviously there are things that subvert this and do it very well, but typically, you know, like I said, visual novels, but dating sims specifically, because you're going to have a character who can date one of eight people, right?
Right.
Realistically. Like, I played Mystic Messenger, and the main character is nothing. She has no eyes. She doesn't do anything that's, like, super relevant the whole time, and the main plot of the game sort of hinges on a backstory that she wasn't there for.
Did you say she has no eyes?
Like, yeah, her bangs cover her eyes the whole time in all of the art.
Okay.
And, you know, Hotiful Boyfriend has an incredibly boring protagonist, though she is funny. But she's mostly very boring, and then major spoilers, she's so boring that for the entire true route, the bad boys love end route, she's dead. Like, she literally gets killed off because she's not relevant
to
the story that's being told.
I have to know, but why is it a world full of birds? What am I missing? They tell you.
They do tell you. But they don't tell her because she's chopped up into several pieces.
Lovely. She then probably has no eyes either.
I don't even think she has, like, a sprite.
No, she doesn't. No, she doesn't. I'm just saying if she's chopped up. No, there is no visualization of her.
Yeah. I mean, I think one, like, key sort of subversion of this, when we're talking about, like, specifically Otome games, because I know we've sort of strayed away from male protagonists here into, like, female protagonists of dating sims, is Cardia and Code Realize, who has, like, a face and a name, and, like, you can play as whatever name you want, but her name is Cardia. And she, like, grows and changes and makes active choices. And there's, like, a whole lot of discussion around her, and most people cite her as a really good subversion of this, because you play as a female character with a personality.
We talked about these blank protagonists. We have really focused on boys. But I think it comes from, one, either a lack of... I think Kim and I have not watched enough shoujo. I think that's the answer.
But that's real. I mean, I can talk about the boring shoujo protagonists that I've watched. I mean, fucking Yuki from Vampire Knight is nothing. She's nothing. I like her. She's nothing.
There's a lot of shoujo where the women are also blank. But I also struggle to see women as quote-unquote blank in the same ways, because the baseline traits that are expected of women are not the same baseline traits that are expected of men in a lot of these takes. So we're far more likely to see a really chipper female lead be a closer thing to a blank lead, because a lot of this media is expecting these women to be like natural caregivers as a desirable trait and such, which deeply upsets me. So I when a woman maybe subverts that and is maybe a little more similar to quote-unquote the blank boy, such as I think maybe Akane from Psycho Pass, I think she's ends up being complex in a completely different way. But I also don't that might get into like an erasure thing or like a dismissal of feminine traits.
No, I mean, I think there's like a complex discussion to be had there, and I don't think you're necessarily dismissing anything just by talking about it, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I think that's a discussion that we can have, and maybe it's a discussion for a different week.
Yeah.
About, like, female protagonists in, like, shoujo or not shoujo.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that you're right. And I mean, I think there is definitely, like, a misogyny to looking at, like, quote-unquote feminine traits as, you know, less interesting or desirable.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that they're, like, deliberately portrayed that way.
Right.
Like, I think that you can have characters who have feminine traits and who are caregivers or whatever, but who also have backstories and interests and things that they like and care about. And yes, I am thinking of Hiyori from Noragami. What of it? but yeah, no, I mean, I don't think that's necessarily either irrelevant or problematic. Anyway, I think we've covered a lot. I think we've talked about a lot of boring boys and some not boring boys, but I think now I'm going to move and say, just to have a clearing of the air, and now, our favorite OPs from shows we have not watched. So these are OPs that we learned about through YouTube videos or recommendations from friends or like quiz things or compilations or Spotify or whatever. So I'm going to start, and on a relevant note, say Beastars, because it slaps. The animation is pretty. I'm not a felty. I don't go for the puppets, typically, or for claymation, but it's really, really pretty and well done. It looks different than everything else out there. And I'm such a sucker for jazzy OPs. Relatedly, Bakano, which also slaps and is jazzy and reminds me of, like, an old-school good Steely Dan jam session. Also relatedly, because apparently I'm on theme today, the first Tokyo Ghoul OP, which is just a classic and uses color in a really stunning way. Paranoia Agent?
Yeah.
Is one that I would not have seen unless you showed it to me, Leanne, but I think is very, very effective. If we're talking about like what makes OPs good, I watch that OP and feel terror down to my bones.
Yeah.
Just like I want to roll over and fall off of a couch or a bed so that I can have a feeling and remind myself that I'm like grounded in a body because I'm scared. So that's a good sign for that show, I guess. Also, because unfortunately I'm me, Black Clover OP10 just is so good. Like, I'm never going to watch Black Clover, but the OPs are all so fun to listen to. Like, jangling piano and, like, sort of off-kilter nature of the music while also having, like, this catchy sort of pop chorus.
Yeah, I could definitely, swap to three of them, despite having never watched the show and having no intention of watching the show.
Mm-hmm. So those are my five.
As someone who has watched all those, except for Black Clover, good choices. Speaking of another long show that I will not watch, I think Bleach OP13 is great. The perspective play is really good. I have some friends who don't appreciate this OP, and I'm not that defensive because I don't care about Bleach, but the perspective play is so good! Anyway.
It's a good OP. There's a reason it tops all of everybody's lists.
My next one is Kokoku, which is just a bop. I heard not many great things about the show, which is sad, but I do watch shows for OPs, like I did for Tokyo Ghoul, so I can't trust myself. I think Haven't You Heard I'm Sakamoto is so funny, and I kind of wish I had watched the show, and I really appreciate humor in an OP, especially since the primary goal of an OP is to set tone and not just to be a bop.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's a funny show, too. It's fucking hilarious as a show.
Good.
I've watched it. It's great.
Domestic Girlfriend has a great OP, and that is probably the one instance where Kim watched an entire show for the OP instead of me.
Yeah, if you were listening earlier and you were like, why has Kim watched Domestic Girlfriend? It's because that OP was so fucking good that I just caved.
And my last one I'll mention is Wolf's Rain, that OP, which I will get to the show eventually this summer, most likely. And I think Kim will too, because we're both deciding to watch that for Momathon. But it's so good. It's got so much. I would sing it, but we don't want that. And I sang it in my notes, though.
I think we're going to have to decide whether we're both banned from singing while recording or whether we both get to sing while we're recording, because neither of us are singers. Yeah, so that was a quick one. But moving on from that into just wrapping up with our seasonal check-in, as it is sort of the second week of the, you know, summer season unofficially. And there are very few shows. I talked a little bit last week about the four that I had started. I've continued all of them, and I'm continuing to, you know, somewhat enjoy all of them. And I'm not going to, like, go through and, like, review the second episode of each, but I think my favorite this week was God of High School, just because I really want that show to be really fun and, like, uplifting, and I'm hopeful that it is. There is sort of a problematic stereotype with a side character based on race, which I'm watching to see how it plays out, but that's something I would warn for when watching the show. But, like, the main trio is all very likable and fun and exciting. So give that a watch if you're looking for something to be kind of uplifting and if you care about martial arts at all. But Decadence pulled some shit this week, which we don't have the time to fully get into, but was like the wildest bait and switch I've almost ever seen in not even just anime, just like any media.
What a choice on that timing. What a choice.
It's just, I don't know. I really liked it. I mean, like, I'm not going to say whether or not it was good because I, like, haven't processed it enough to decide whether or not I thought it was quote unquote good, but I liked it.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to contribute to that. I'm not going to contribute to this. I will continue it or I won't continue it. I don't know yet.
That's fair. I tend to be the one who likes the more sort of out of nowhere plot turns.
Okay, just because V3 is an example doesn't mean I don't like any of them.
No, I'm not saying you don't like any of them. I'm just saying that I tend to be more forgiving of random bullshit, which is not a bad reflection on you. It's a bad reflection on me and my, like, abysmally low standards for media in general. I did feel like I was watching part Attack on Titan and part, like, Flapjack on Cartoon Network.
I think I saw someone describe it as a cross between Caponeri of the Iron Fortress and The Amazing World of Gumball.
Fuck. That's so, like, Fuck, that's like basically what I said, but like a little different. I'm glad that people are on the same page about the branding of the show.
I like how I described it last night, but that might be too much of a spoiler.
I'm not going to spoil it by saying what exactly happened, but watch the first episode. If you like it, watch the second episode, and you will immediately, I think, know whether or not you're feeling it.
I say watch the first episode. If you don't like it, watch the second episode. And that might give...
That's fair. I'm willing to see how it plays out.
No, but I'm saying...
No, you're right. The tone shifts.
Right. You can't say that if you didn't like the first episode that you won't like the rest.
Yes, it's true.
I just want to say on Origairu that Iroha is a legend, and that's all I have to say.
I continue my OT3 feelings for Origairu even more strongly this week.
You're right and valid, and I'm there with you.
And maybe I'm saying this like mostly as a Yui Yui Gahama stan, hashtag Yui rights, which is rare for me liking the pink-haired one that much.
It is true. This is a rare call for you.
Yeah, but I love her, and I'm excited to see where it goes. And now I'm thinking about Hachiman as a subversion of a boring harem protagonist. In any case, if I'm not wrong, I think that's kind of all we have for this week.
That should be it.
Well, on that note, anything you want to, last words you have, Leanne?
Just watch Chihayahuru. I didn't get to say it last week.
I feel very bad that I said last words as if I'm going to kill you right now, and that's how this podcast is going to end.
Okay, if I have last words, if you're going to kill me right now, it's that I feel deep regret over not including Taiga from Fates Day Night last week in the short-haired anime women, because she deserved to be on there, and I'm so sorry. I love you.
I'll tell her you said that. I'll pass on your message.
At dinner. Tell her at dinner. You'll have a lot of meals together soon.
Jesus, what am I getting myself into?
Fun.
And on that note, bye everyone.
Bye.